Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Bend a Table, a monthly food subscription service for avid home cooks focused on delicious and sustainable pantry items. Learn more at bendatable.com. That's BENTOTABLE.com. And when you use code HRN for a new subscription, you get $20 off, and we at HRN get 10 bucks. Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from Lower Manhattan. Well, Matt's in Rhode Island, and John's in Murray Hill, and Jack's in Brooklyn, and we have a special guest, Angela, who'll get to, is in Lincoln, Nebraska. Not Roberta's Pizzeria, because none of us are open, and no one's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Welcome. Welcome to the show. Oh, the Blue Angels, I guess, are outside, so there's some fighter jets going over my house.
You know, burning up. Flying over out of to pay their respects for your work on Cooking Issues, Dave.
That's right. It's because there's nothing I want more than to be trapped inside and to hear thunderous jets overhead, and not actually get to see them. You know what I mean?
You're welcome.
Yeah. I got once buzzed by a. What was it? Was it a Hornet, like an F-18 or something, in the Panamint Mountains on my way to Death Valley? Because there was no one else in the entire valley where we were. And this jet was like, there's something moving. I'll buzz it. And it was like, right over the car. And I was like, dang, that stuff's impressive. Like, you know, fighter jets is impressive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they are.
Yeah. So, we are Stasless today. We have no Nastasia Lopez because she's working with, one of those Jose Andres, COVID-related charities today doing coordination or something like that, helping people help each other. So, whatever, we'll give her a pass. I won't even rib her about it because she's doing the right thing. But in the place of Nastasia, we have Wacky Jackie Schramm. Head bartender. Hello. Of the currently closed, but hopefully soon to reopen existing condition. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Doing well. And of course, we got new regular on the show, John from Booker and Dax, the new Spinzall and Searsall customer service guru. How you doing? And special guest today. And we have her for the whole time. Long time, friend of mine from back, all the way back to my French Culinary Institute days. And I've never pronounced her last name twice the same way. So we'll do it, and I'll have her pronounce it. I'll try to do it the way I think she pronounces it. And then we'll, so Angela Garbitz, is that the way you pronounce it?
That's actually perfect, yeah.
Yeah, because we used to just call her like G-Botch, Garbotch, anything other than her actual name. But Angela just wrote, she's the owner, founder of Goldenrod Pastries in Lincoln, Nebraska, correct?
Correct, yes.
Yeah. And one of my super favorite people. And we can get into the kind of the story. Although you've been on their show before, right?
Yep, I have.
Yeah. But she just came out with her very first book called Perfectly Golden. Now, you want me to give the 30-second spiel on how we got to where we are? You want it? Okay.
Do it, yeah.
All right. So I first, what year did you go to the FCI?
2008.
Okay. So I first met you in 2008. You came to do pastry. So I used to have this intern program at the French Culinary Institute. And anyone who is coming in, either in the pastry or the culinary programs, in the six-month professional program, they could come and we would work on kind of fun new techniques and technologies. And right away, Angela came, and I guess you had taken a break from college, or had you finished? You took a break, right?
I did a culinary science program. And so we had to go, we had to get X number of culinary school credits. And so that was kind of, I really didn't want to go to college and I wanted to go to pastry school. And this was kind of my in to do both. And I had actually, I don't know if you remember this, but I couldn't choose a pastry school. And then a friend of mine showed me an article featuring you in Popular Science in the fall of 2007. Oh, and man. I was like, oh my God, this guy's so cool. This guy's doing such cool stuff. And he's at this school. Little did I know. And so I went and did a tour at FCI. And I think you, I was like, this guy's a, you know, you are also one of my super favorite people. And I remember the first time that we met, you were in the amphitheater doing an interview with New York Times. And I was doing my tour. I think Jock was taking me around. And he's like, oh, and this is Dave. I know you wanted to do that internship. And you like totally halted your interview with the New York Times. And you're like, hey, what's up? What are you doing? Who are you? What do you want to do? And I was like, oh my gosh, this guy's cool. He just shut down the New York Times.
Well, you know, look, honestly, like say what you want. People can say what they want about culinary school education. But I know I was, and I think the entire school, especially back then, I haven't been back in a little while, but like we were pretty student focused. We wanted people to feel, you know, well, we actually did care. I thought we cared. I felt like we
cared. For sure. And it really felt that way. So I ended up going to French Culinary Institute just because of the internship with you. And that's how I met some of my best buds, actually.
Oh, man. Well, I was super glad that you did. We were, you know, anytime it was super rare for us to have someone in with any sort of science background or any even kind of affinity for it. I mean, it's a funny thing. Like cooking schools are funny because they are an incredible cross section of people and they only really mostly share. And we had some people in who, you know, their parents were paying and they just wanted to be shoemakers, whatever, fine. But, which is, I don't really understand. Why insult shoemakers? Not an easy thing to make well. Shoes, not an easy thing to make well. Why do we insult shoemakers? What is that?
Who is we? Who is insulting shoemakers?
Chefs. Chefs insult it was like, hey, is this guy a good cook? Ah, they're a shoemaker. You know what I mean?
I would rather learn how to make food than make shoes. That sounds really hard.
I think the implication is that they're turning food into shoes, like overcooking a steak.
I don't think they're insulting
a shoemaker.
No. The insult was that they were merely a craftsperson and not an artiste. So like a shoemaker was someone who like showed up at work and like just did what they were going to do. And they did a good, person's like job at it. They were okay at it. You know what I mean? But there was no inspiration. You know what I mean? There was nothing like, nothing.
They're the lifeblood of the entire industry. The people who show up and do the work well every day.
Yeah. But when you love that person, you're like, they're a monster. They're a crank. They're sick.
True.
But when they're just kind of like, when you want them to be a leader and all they're doing is that stuff, you're like, man, a shoemaker. You know what I mean? But again, I think it's a false, because making shoes, not easy. Making good shoes, not easy. In the same way that making good food's not easy. Anyway, so I don't even know how I got on that. So anyway, so you come in, you do the internship. We had an amazing group of people at the time. And then you go, and by the way, you worked at like some amazing kitchens here in New York while you were here. I mean, and like worked like a dog. You went from either in class to like the internship and then off to work. I mean, did you sleep ever? What was your deal?
So it's funny that you ask. It was a wild time. I mean, I was there and I knew that like I wouldn't be able to afford to stay after. So I was like, I'll just do everything I can right now. So we were at school really late doing the internship. And I started doing a bread internship for a short time before I started class in the morning. So I was doing either your internship or at Jean Georges until like, you know, usually Jean Georges was later till like midnight or one. And then I'd show up for the bread at like 6 and then do a day of class and do the internship. It was like 5 days a week. And then I worked at Jean Georges on Saturday. So I would go home. I don't know if you ever knew this. The only thing I had to eat in my apartment, because I was eating everywhere else, was kielbasa from a great Ukrainian butcher in the Lower East Side, and I had beer. And so I would go home every night and have open a beer and boil one sausage while I got ready for bed. And I would lay in bed and eat half a sausage while I passed out.
That's incredible.
I like that.
That's which butcher?
I can't remember the name. It was like URDZ is what it started with.
Is that the one?
It was on the
on
west
second?
Side of the street. That's all.
On Second Avenue?
Yeah.
I don't know if that place is still
East
there.
Village Meat Market. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is that still there, Jack?
Yeah. The kielbasa is excellent.
It's the best kielbasa.
It's so good.
Especially
a lot of kielbasa. I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Good. You know, today with the book launch, I was supposed to be in New York, and I was actually going to have a party at Existing Conditions tonight. That was like my dream. That was the plan, and it's nice that we can kind of still catch up together somehow.
So let me finish this though. The best kielbasa, Angela, is the one you have at 2 a.m. in your house.
Yeah,
that's always the best kielbasa.
Yeah,
if you can't have the kielbasa you love, Angela. Yeah. Love the kielbasa you're with. Although I hate the premise of that song. I really hate the premise of that song. Don't you hate the premise of that song? If you can't be with the one you love,
really
love the one you're with.
Yeah, I guess I'll just settle.
It's the weakest. Yeah. It's fine. Anyway, doesn't make any sense to me. So anyway, so then you go back and then you develop. Now, by the way, for those of you that have never met Angela, like, would you know, not a picky bone in Angela's body. No pickiness, no nothing, right? So when I learned that she had just like developed an allergy to dairy, first I thought she was kidding. I thought she was kidding me. You know what I mean? And then she's like, no, I really have to change my life around it, and kind of put you on this road that brought you where you are now. You want to talk about that at all?
Yeah, so I started a blog that I called Goldenrod Pastries in like 2013, 2014, because, you know, I went to the French Culinary Institute. I'd been baking for myself my whole life. Everything goes with butter, milk, cream, whatever. And like, I love to eat and I love cake. I love having dessert with every meal. It's how I was raised, believe it or not. And so I just realized that I had to start developing recipes that I could eat that didn't make me sick. So I started my blog and I started posting these recipes, posting pictures, and pretty soon people started reaching out to me and saying like, oh my gosh, well, I can't have dairy either. I can't have eggs, or I'm gluten-free. I'm 35 years old. I haven't had a donut since I was 6 years old. I was like, oh my God, there's all these people who are totally being left out of like the food conversation. And as a chef, like first and foremost, like I want to feed people. And so I started developing recipes and they started asking for birthday cakes and donuts and all these things that I had no idea how to make with their dietary restrictions. But I just kind of started going and trying to figure it out, because when you love to feed people, there's nothing worse than not being able to feed them. And so I just kind of started. And within a year of launching the blog, I opened my first storefront in May of 2015. And we are, I would say, 95% dairy-free, gluten-free, or vegan gluten-free. And I think what's really, really cool about that is that most of our customers do not need or choose to eat that way. So we're making food that I think and I hope is really, really good just because it's good. Like, we use sorghum flour for our cookies, and I think that makes, like, to me, a better cookie than I was eating with all-purpose flour. Or like, we use a rice flour blend in our pound cakes, and I think that makes a super tender pound cake. And, you know, I just found that there's a way to make food actually taste as good, if not better, and still be able to feed more people.
Yo, Matt, is Bob's Red Mill still a sponsor of the I know not our program, but are they still on the Heritage at all?
No, not currently.
They should pay Angela money, because people don't know how to rep stuff like sorghum flour properly. You know why? This is why I love Angela so much, because, right, she's got a mission to use it, like, or to not use, or to be able to not use a certain subset of ingredients, but she always comes from a point of what's going to make this thing more delicious. It's never like some sort of goofy, like, BS, like, pseudo health mumbo jumbo. It's just like, here are the givens of what I can work with. How can I make the best possible, most delicious product? Not, you know, like, and that, like, to have someone whose guiding principle is the delicious, but then also a kind of take on like this subset of ingredients or take on certain constraints, I think is a really great attitude for today. And someone like Bob's Red Mill, who you bring up in your book, should pay you some money. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, we're working on that. But I think like what's really interesting in like the interviews that I've been having about the book with different people is they're like, oh, so why did you choose like this health focus? And I was like, it's not about health. Like if you look through this book and you eat our food, it has like a lot of fat and a lot of sugar in it. And as like a dairy-free fat, I really like shortening for a lot of different things and a lot of different reasons. It doesn't have off flavors like a lot of vegan butters do. And a lot of people just, when they're making food for dietary restrictions or dietary preferences, they leave out the fat and sugar. And like, that is when it starts getting a bad reputation.
Yeah, that sounds terrible.
Right?
I mean, everyone's always known that shortening makes very good textures on things like biscuits and pie crust. But I guess the gripe, there's two gripes, right? There's the health gripe, which I don't care about. I mean, whatever. You know what I mean? You know me.
Yeah.
And then there is the neutrality argument, where it's like, if you can have the flavor of butter, I would choose the flavor of butter over the, some argue, superior texture of shortening and some of those things. Where,
for sure.
What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that butter has a better flavor than shortening. But if you take butter out of the equation, what you're left with is either shortening or butter alternatives, like vegan butter alternatives. And I personally haven't found any that don't create like a really intense off flavor.
Yeah.
And like when I started baking dairy-free and vegan, it was just awful. All I could taste was just like plastic.
Well, and you specifically say don't use fake butter, like don't use spray that has fake butter flavor.
Yeah.
Because it's terrible. That's the reason why not to use it.
It's terrible. And sometimes it has dairy products in it.
That's another reason.
But like even, the spray, yeah, in the terrible nonstick sprays. But yeah, like those vegan butters for me, I just haven't found one that's like, I mean, both you're looking at also like cost effectiveness and accessibility. And that's another thing with this book that I really think is important, which is like so relevant right now, is like financial accessibility for people. We have to get more people in the kitchen. Like I think that we have so many people in the kitchen right now, and if we give them financially accessible and technique accessible recipes, that's like so great. Why are we trying to create recipes that leave people out of the conversation as far as baking? Like get in the kitchen. Everybody wants to bake. Make recipes, develop recipes that people can make with what they have and with, you know, hopefully an economic situation that, you know, it
Thank
doesn't
you
require the most money.
For saying that, that's incredible. It's an epidemic in the cocktail world right now with people posting these recipes that are like, oh, you know, fat washed this, it, like all of these techniques that no home bartenders are ever going to use. It's like, just give people simple drinks right now.
Well, that's the other thing. But that's what we do for a living, Jack. So then, I mean,
exactly.
You have two livings, but yes.
Yeah.
Or
like
one
I,
now.
You know, at the bakery, there's some stuff that we do that like technique wise or economically, it makes a lot more sense to do in a commercial setting. And while I was writing this book and talking to my editor and just thinking about like, actually, would I feel comfortable as Angela Garbutz giving these recipes to somebody and saying, oh yeah, go ahead and figure that out. But you have to go ahead. Like, yes, you do have to like go out of your way to get some of these gluten-free ingredients. But I actually recommend to people commercially available GF flour mixes as opposed to buying like a ton of different ingredients, because it is financially so inaccessible for a lot of people. So I think you have to, like, when you're giving the general public information about your skill and your art, like what can we do to make more people part of the conversation and make them comfortable? And like, we can use those really cool techniques and the really expensive products at home for ourselves.
Well, also, I noticed on your things, and I was making a note of it to myself, that, you know, you say that you've made all these recipes with commercial mixes, and so just, you know, like your go-tos that you do, you use more of one than the other, one of Bob Redmill's flours, and see, New Life, Pamela's, and for a few things, King Arthur. But what I love about your book here is that you say exactly why you use a particular flour for a particular application, and then you give the main ingredients in case somebody wants to do a knockoff or figure out kind of what is in those flours to use them, which I thought was a great you know, thing in the book. But I was curious, because you say you actually use them at the shop, and are those things still cost effective when you're doing it professionally, more so than just like trying to womp that stuff yourself, or is it that you like the consistency of the mixes or what?
For the most part, it is more cost effective right now. Starting at the end of February and definitely going into March, we actually started making our own mixes because it became so much more expensive to buy these blends. So we did have to start making our own, but for the most part, like buying in the ingredients, and you know, we have a super small space, which I know you guys can relate to. And it actually was like cost effective for us to just buy these already made. But as things change, as supply chains change, like we're definitely going to have to look at that a little differently.
I know places like King Arthur do 50-pound sacks, but I didn't know Bob's Red Mill did 50-pound sacks.
Yeah, we get 25 pounds from Bob's Red Mill. And yeah, it's great. We go through so much of it. But also, yeah, like the main ingredient list, I think, is really important, because if you're looking at your local co-op, like I know my local co-op has like some brands like I can't find elsewhere. But if I'm somebody looking at this book and I see this blend at my co-op, I can look back in the book and say, okay, well, it primarily has this in it. And now I know that if xanthan gum is third on the list of ingredients, then that's going to be like a pretty gummy flower. So maybe I should find something else. So I hope that it can be like a good guide for people and like teach them how to use what's available to them as well.
Yeah. And so like all of your recipes, you write down kind of which one of the flours you use. And, you know, I just would tell people, I think it's a very good way to do things, is to like let people know why you're using a particular kind of flour. I thought that was a nice touch. One thing I have a question about is you write, and I've never used it before, Pamela's gluten-free all-purpose baking flour. And you write in it that it's the hardest one of the ones to use, that it can actually overmix. And then I looked at the ingredient list. Overmix meaning you can overwork, because one of the advantages of gluten-free that you point out is that, you know, there's no gluten to either over or underwork. So, you know, in a way, you know, it kind of frees you up in for some recipes in terms of worrying about it. I don't know, just toughening something like a cake or et cetera. But you write that this particular flour can be overworked, and I've looked at the ingredients: brown rice flour, tapioca starch, white rice flour, potato starch, sorghum, guar gum, and guar gum. So what is it that overworks in that? Like, I'm wondering what it is about that particular mix.
It's the gum.
The guar?
It's the gum. And I don't know if it's how the gums take up the liquid, and if they, like, I assume they just keep absorbing more liquid, but it just becomes a completely gummy mass. So we use Pamela's mostly for like cake batters. It makes really nice like layer cakes. But if you know, you're trying to work out the clumps in your batter, for example, if you don't like add your dry and wet and dry and wet, like just right with Pamela's, that guar gum is going to just like really kind of seize up.
Guar is guar is an awesome word, by the
guar.
Way.
Guar.
This episode brought to you by Bend to Table, a monthly food subscription service for avid home cooks focused on delicious and sustainable pantry items. I recently received the Essentials box, and one of my favorite items in that box was the Jimmy Red Grits from Geechee Boy Mill. And these Jimmy Red Grits are, first of all, it would be hard to overstate how delicious these grits are, especially, I mean, a lot of you out there might never have even made grits in your life, if you come from somewhere that's not a grit place. And if you have, you're probably used to just kind of buying grits in those kind of brown paper sleeves in the supermarket. And this is really not a comparable product. Just the kind of punch corn flavor you're gonna get out of these grits is kind of out of this world. And I did these in a rice cooker. I did them with milk. And then after they had cooked out, I folded in a little bit of grated cheese, some shrimp that I had cooked with bacon. So I crisped up the bacon, took it aside, cooked the shrimp up in the bacon grease, then took that, folded it in with some cheese and a little bit of garlic, and good to go. That was my kind of lighter version of shrimp and grits made with Jimmy Red Grits. Delicious. Go to bentotable.com to start your own monthly subscription. Use the discount code HRN to get $20 off a new subscription, and Bentotable will donate $10 to support Cooking Issues and all of HRN's programming. So one thing that we'll go back a little bit, because we got into the weeds on flour and we didn't even get to talk about the kind of the basics of the book or the stuff beforehand. But in the very introduction, I think you have the kind of pull out quote at the very beginning that kind of shows your attitude, which is the same attitude actually that we have at existing conditions, I hope, is that I want, and this is your quote, I want you to have a seat at our table. In other words, you want everyone to be able to come in to Goldenrod and enjoy what you're doing kind of no matter what. Inclusive baking, which is, I guess, did you come up with that term?
I didn't hear it before me, but maybe, some, yeah, I think I did.
So, and I love that, because that's kind of the same mentality that, you know, we have, at least this go around, you know, now at XCon, in terms of non-alcoholic drinks, is just why would you not want someone to feel welcome, right?
For sure. It's like, you know, there's always going to be some allergy or some restriction or preference that like you can't meet, which is so frustrating. But for the most part, it's like, you don't want to turn people away. And like the joy that somebody feels and that you can see when they're like, oh man, you have something non-alcoholic, and like, who cares what their reasons are for not drinking alcohol? And it's like the same thing with dietary stuff. I always hear people say, oh, well, you know, they're probably just faking it or making it up. And it's like, I don't really care. Like, that's a person's choice. Like, if they choose not to drink alcohol, if they choose not to eat gluten or dairy or whatever, that's like totally cool. And that's none of my business. And my only goal is to make food, pastries, more inclusive for people. And I don't care what your reasons are of why you don't eat these things. And that's your choice. And I don't want food to feel so exclusive. I want it to be more welcoming.
Yeah, I think that is, everyone should feel that way.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So, and then yeah. Another thing it's, you know, I think it's kind of cool is that you write predominantly, but is it all, like you have a thing, woman-powered baking, right? And like most of the staff, or I don't know, maybe at this point, all of your staff, I know at one point, I think all of your staff was women. You want to talk about that kind of, that kind of business. My wife is the same way with her architecture business. She actually runs an all women's architecture business and she loves it.
Yeah. So we were all women until about a year ago. And now we have a couple of guys working for us, which is super awesome. I actually doubled my staff at the beginning of March, right before I opened my second location this year. Great month to open a second location. Like the woman power thing, like I just woke up one day and realized that, you know, I was in a kitchen setting. I was in a life setting where I was surrounded by all women. And not only did I feel comfortable, but I felt empowered. And I felt like these women were there to support me and not, you know, as women talking to a group of guys here. But like as women, I think that, you know, for a long time, the idea was there was only room at the table for, you know, one woman in each field to be doing well. And I think that conversation is changing, and it's a really damaging and hurtful sort of commentary. But I think that, you know, for me, feeling empowered by this group of women I was working with really allowed me to like be more creative and be more ambitious with what I was doing with my business. And so I try to talk about that in the book, because I hope that, you know, some people who read this, some young women who feel, you know, a little bit lost or, you know, hurt by other people in their lives, or for whatever reason are looking for a little bit of inspiration and hope, they can sit down with Perfectly Golden and it can be something that really inspires them to not only invest in other women, but also feel like they deserve that as well. But yeah, that's something that's pretty important to me.
Yeah. I know she's not in the food industry. That's why she hasn't come on. But Jen, my wife, has like, you know, voice a lot of the same thing. It's just kind of a different, what she says, it's like a different feel to the business. And it, you know, it's something that she thinks is super valuable. And I, you know, so I have to agree with her because she's right about 99.9% of the things.
I think Jane, that she says. I think Jane's pretty much right about it all.
I mean, Yes, I mean, she's maybe a little conservative on what she wants me to do with my physical human flesh sack because she's worried I'm going to break it. But, you know, like...
Yeah, I'm still upset. I'm still upset she didn't let you deep fry yourself.
I know it. Well, the thing is, if I hadn't lit myself on fire so badly with the St. George piece, I think she would have let me deep fry myself. But the fact that I so badly misjudged what it was going to be like to catch on fire, I think kind of, you know, poisoned the well a little bit on trusting my quote unquote engineering skills when it came to the safety of my human form. So, I mean, I can see where she's coming from on that one, but
I mean, I can't think of a more horrible demise than, yeah, the fire suit, the fryer suit failing. Like, can you imagine?
No, that would be real bad.
A leak spring and just having the vessel that you're inside of slowly fill with boiling oil.
It would be real bad.
God.
So, I mean, you know, Angela, you'll sympathize with this. So I was using my super duper, you know, like ridiculously expensive waffle iron. Also not a good time to have bought that waffle iron. But anyway, so like in a Liege waffle, there's always melted sugar and butter in the waffle iron and you just let it ride. And so like, you know, the waffle N minus one contributes its melted sugar to waffle N and waffle N plus one, along with extra butter that's leaking out of the double butter brioche dough as you're making it. Anyways, so I was trying to get something out and I missed and dipped my pinky into the molten sugar well of the thing.
Oh,
and, oh man, nothing's more fun than a molten sugar burn, am I right?
That is not a good burn. The first thing you always want to do with a sugar burn is, like they told us in school, I always remember this, if you get a sugar burn on your finger, the first thing you want to do is like put it in your mouth, and that's the last thing you want to do.
Because your mouth is warm, you mean? Just like...
I don't know, just a weird reflex, but...
You know what I did? I cursed.
Yeah.
I cursed myself. It was my fault. I should not have done it.
You know, I really think that honestly, you invested in that waffle iron at the perfect time, because now you have Liege waffles whenever you want. I think I ruined three just like Cuisinart Belgian waffle makers making Liege waffles over the years because I just never wanted to like fork over the cash for a real one. Like that sugar is no joke.
Yeah. But you know what though? You, like I would love for you to figure out the goldenrod version of the Liege waffle and get you one of them Liege waffle irons because first of all, like the things that they sell in the U.S. as Belgian waffle make, it's an insult to the entire country of Belgium. Now, Belgium does. Now, John, Matt kicked John off the radio program today. So, you know, he can't sit here and defend his Belgian self. But like in the way that Canadian bacon that they serve here is an insult to Canadians and their what they call bacon, like Belgian waffle as we make it is a freaking insult, man. Well, when you come back to New York, you know, you can I'll get the extra butter out of my iron and you can we'll run through some stuff.
Sounds great.
Now, one bone to pick before I go further. You use cup measurements at the shop?
Oh, yeah. That is a bone that a lot of people picked with me in the process of writing this book. Yeah, I don't know. So sue me.
Good answer.
I mean, I don't want to sue you, but
boom.
I mean, I'm just saying. I know you have at least one of the medium-sized Hobarts, and you're showing up there with a cup measure and like leveling off and like whipping your flour bucket up so that you can get the loft exactly the same way each time, and doing the roop doop a scoop drop and level.
Well,
I mean. In the real life, or do you have like a cup measure the size of my head?
Well, we have for sure converted some to just like, you know, we use like some 25 quart containers. And so I know how many cups are in there, or not 25 quart, 25 cup containers. But, you know, we're not doing a lot of leveling off. We're just really kind of, it's the Wild West.
Yeah. Well, you know what they say about Nebraska?
It's the Wild West.
Possibilities.
Yeah, the possibilities are endless.
Endless. I wish you guys had kept that motto. The motto is so much better than your new motto.
Here's a good Nebraska story, Dave connection. He actually went to school with the mayor of Lincoln, Nebraska.
That's true. Lirian. Mayor Lirian. Yeah. Yeah. How's she doing over there?
She's killing it. We have a really conservative state government who is really just going ahead and opening the state back up starting next week when our cases are like, I mean, just really out of it's out of control. And so obviously not a good time to open up the state, but Lyrian's holding strong and really trying to like keep her control over our city at least. And, keep it as safe as possible.
Well, she's good people. Say howdy for me when you see her.
I will.
One quick question. On the same page where you say that you use cup measurements, I'm still picking that bone. You also say something about on your yeast doughs that they should be impossibly fluffy before they go in the oven. And my question is on proofing in general, when you're doing gluten-free, do you proof differently from when you're doing a recipe with gluten or not in terms of how much loft you get before you put it in to the oven?
Yeah. So it's funny you pick out that term specifically because that was actually coined by Mindy Lavoff herself, one of the people who worked for Dave and was in the internship program when I was there. She coined the impossibly fluffy term. So gluten-free for sure has a little bit in the recipes in the book. We don't do like a first proof. Like you make the dough, for example, if you're making cinnamon rolls, you make the dough and then you just immediately start portioning it out and start rolling it out for buns. So like there's no first proof. And then like what we do at the bakery is we put them in the freezer and we take them out and proof them as we need them before we bake them. So it's definitely a similar process in the sense that, you know, we want to get some good rise. If you don't get good rise from your yeast products that are gluten-free before they go in the oven, that's when you're going to end up with like a hockey puck. And so I end up using a little bit more yeast than a lot of gluten-free yeast buns that I have recipes that I've looked at, because you really have to make sure that you get that rise. And with a little bit of extra yeast in your gluten-free products, you're going to see that. So we still do the rise before it bakes, but there's not a first proof.
One other question on ingredients before we go on to main sections of the book and whatnot. Because one of the nice things about the book is that there's a little checkoff thing calling what's called you do you, where you say you can make this recipe completely traditionally and some you can't, some only, you know, don't work traditionally. And you say like kind of which ones you can do. So it's like a pick your own on the whole thing. But in your ingredients section, you say that when you're going to put dairy milk back into a recipe that was formulated for either almond milk, which is your typical one, or coconut, depending, that you use 1-2% instead of regular whole. Is that because, even though, you know, I find them execrable, is that because they more closely match the recipes that have been tested with the non-dairy milks?
Yes, yeah, that is exactly it. So like a whole milk is not going to have the same consistency as like an almond milk or an oat milk or coconut milk.
Oh, and by the way, you know how I know we're exactly the same about a lot of things? I read one section. I got to find the exact quote. But oh, here it is. You write. You'll know when it's done. Just speaking about when employees first come in and start working for you, and they're like, "How long is this? How long is this guy a cook?" Or how much? You say they saw recipes at Goldenrod. They saw recipes that read simply salt or vanilla or even spices with no measurements listed. They asked where to find working oven timers, as the one in our convection oven had recently stopped working, as they all do. You'll know when it's done, is what you told them, which at first they didn't believe and looked at me stunned. And so it's like, I think people don't understand, especially in baking, or I know people always get on me about like, because like, you know, my job theoretically is to be precise and scientific about everything, but like my standard amount is how much salt should I add? The right amount, you idiot.
Exactly.
Yeah, some. The correct amount.
Exactly.
How long am I supposed to bake it till it's done?
And like that's what makes it so hard. Like, I mean, when you're writing a baking book for me, what's really challenging is like actually giving those precise times specifically or temperatures, because I do not have your oven. I do not have your kitchen. And so I think what's really important and what I really tried to do with this book was to give people the skills to understand what it looks like when it's done. and what it feels like when it's done. Because it is impossible for me to tell you exactly at what moment, at what minute, at which minute you should take it out of the oven. And that's why timers are irrelevant in the kitchen. So like if it breaks, then it's like the sooner the better. But yeah, my poor...
Especially...
Go ahead.
In home kitchens when most humans don't have oven thermometers and don't even know how hot their oven is to begin with.
Yeah.
I mean, in most home kitchens, you can almost bake by smell because the kitchen, the extraction, the hoods are so bad in kitchens that you can pretty much smell when something's done. You know what I mean?
And it's like, I always tell my bakers too, and this is a little bit different in a home kitchen, but, you should always kind of get in the mindset that something's in the oven. And I always kind of, I tell my bakers, like, we're not using timers because that's not really going to help you, but just always be thinking like, oh, every 5 minutes, every however often, do I have anything in the oven? Is there anything that I should check? And when you're at home, it's like, once you start getting more comfortable, you'll get to that point where you're like, oh yeah, I have something in the oven. And maybe that's just me. Maybe I'm just kind of a freak, but you'll smell it and you'll start to get familiar. And like, it's a very sensory thing. Like, yes, you can use a timer, but when something is done, smell the air. Smell like, and remember what it smells like. And that way, when you're just like kicking it on your couch, you can smell and be like, oh yeah, this is what it smells like when it's done.
But like that little genie with a baseball bat that hits you in the back of your head when you're cooking it's like, hey, you idiot, you haven't checked on the oven in a while. Can you teach someone to have that?
Yes, you can. I have seen it be taught.
Huh.
Yeah. I mean, and it comes from a lot of years and or months of me being like, hey, you have stuff in the oven. Because I'm always thinking about it. And so the last thing they want is for me to remind them again that they have something in the oven. So they start remembering before I remind them.
It's like sense of urgency.
Yeah,
it's difficult to teach, but it's possible. Some people have it more innately than others, but no one is just born with that, you know, I must continue to work at all times. You have to
build. I also have really, really good bakers. So that might be part of it too.
Sure. I'm sure that no shortage of people want to work with you over there.
Impossible to understate, the importance of having a good team.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
It's the best thing in the world.
You know, I'm sure you're a very good leader, and so you can get a good team, which is half of it.
We try to, for sure.
So then you write in the, I keep on saying I'm going to get into the meat of the book, and then I never do because I'm still on the like ingredient section. You use a tip that obviously I agree with, which is salt all the time, always salt. But before you say anything, I have a specific question for you, and since you are the queen of making sure everyone has a place at the table, hopefully you can answer this question that came in on Twitter this morning for you from Darren Vengroff. Any tips for baking for people on very low sodium diets? Potassium-based leaveners are available and are sort of okay if you adjust formulas based on the molecular weight of the salts, but it's hard to replace in yeast breads and yeast breads also perform differently without salt, though using a long low temp proofing seems to help somewhat, but the flavor of the wheat doesn't come through in the same way.
That is such a tough one. I really feel for people who, you know, there's low sodium and then there's what that guy just wrote in. And that, like I said a little bit ago, there's always going to be something that we just can't, we just can't figure out. And that's one thing that, you know, I don't have a good answer for.
But is it one of those things where it's always in the back of your mind and someday you'll solve it? I mean, that I have problems like
one that. One in particular is not. We haven't had too many people come in with that, but I mean, now it's going to be always in the back of my mind for sure. Yeah.
Well, when you solve it, you're going to let us know.
I'll let Darren know when I figure it out.
Hey, how come banana bread takes so long to bake?
It's just real wet, I guess.
But it's like impossibly long, right? It looks like it's done and it's not, and it's not even half done.
And I mean,
it
just gets so dark too. And I think that like a lot of people are like, well, it's done. I guess I'll just take it out because it looks done. And it's really just mostly not ever done if it looks done.
I know. But it tastes so good and it's so theoretically easy, but it just gives me agita all the time. How long it takes to cook. Huh. I mean, that little freaking loaf pan, 50 minutes, 50-something minutes.
It's like a joke, right?
Yeah. And after like 25 minutes, you're like, hey, it's already risen all the way. It's done. And then I'm like, oh my God, it's going to burn. So then I put aluminum foil over the top because it freaks me out. The whole thing freaks me out.
So,
gives me agita. Hate it.
Dave Arnold, love the bread. The thing that really gets him is the banana bread. He can do just anything else, but it's the thing that gets him is the banana bread.
Yeah. Light me on fire. Toss me off a building. Fine. The banana bread, how long it takes to bake, kill me, kill me. Oh, by the way, another good tip you give, even for home people. A lot of times, people like, for instance, your Alton Brown and whatnot, they'll tell you not to buy kitchen equipment to have that they consider a unitasker or whatnot. But you write in making the cookie section, go get you a number 24 scoop. I would say get a range of dosing scoops in your house. No one's ever said to me, hey, you know what pisses me off? That I can now dose out muffins and cookies accurately.
It's like a gift to have those at home. And I actually don't, up until recently, up until the last month, I haven't been baking at home for like the past 5 years. And I'm so pissed I don't have my dosing mechanisms at home. It is the one thing I really, really want in my kitchen. And I go through the supplies section in detail and very clearly say you don't have to spend a ton of money on your supplies. But the things that I do encourage people to get are actually things that are going to make a difference.
Yeah, if you've never had the dosing scoops in your house and you do any kind of baking whatsoever, you will thank Angela for this tip. By the way, don't use them on ice cream. They actually suck for untempered ice cream. No one in the world who's not a pastry chef tempers their freaking ice cream before they scoop it, and dosers are rancid at going in because you always rip the little swipe doodle out when you're going through ice cream that's too hard. Because guess what, people? That's not what they're for.
Agree.
Yeah. So I will also I want to, because I don't want to forget this before we make it, that Angela has the greatest quote of all times in the book, and the quote is this: there are many different kinds of muffin people.
Yeah.
I want you to all think about that statement and ask yourself, what kind of muffin person are you? Because there are so many different kinds of muffin.
If I can just quickly tell you about a kind of muffin person I met once at my store. She came up to me at the counter, and there's, you know, the couple feet divider of the counter between us. And she said, so what kind of muffins do you have today? And I was like, well, I mean, I think they were like blueberry and raspberry or something with crumble on top. And like, and I told her, and she's like, so that's just like what you have today. And I was like, yeah, that's what we have today. And she's like, so what do you do? Do you just like wake up in the morning and just decide this is the kind of muffin you're going to make today? And I was like, yeah, it is, I guess. And she reached across the 2 or 3 foot counter and put a thumbs down inches away from my face.
Wow.
Oh.
That's my muffin story.
Did you ever find out what kind of muffin she was expecting?
She sounds like a poppy seed person.
It's super hard to say. She for sure left. And yeah, it's hard to know what kind of muffin people you're going to run into. We have had tons of different kinds of muffin people in my store.
Yeah. I mean, everyone has in their mind what they want their muffin to be.
Or like,
you know,
do they want the crumble on top? Do they want like the crunchy sugar on top? Do they want like chunks in there? Do they want it to be smooth? Like my bakers really don't like chunks in their muffins. I am a big chunk in my muffin person. Like I want to find different things throughout my muffin. And so that is like our muffin standard at the store. And they're always bummed when I'm like, oh wow, you went ahead and just like made those berries into like preserves for the muffins, huh? And it's like, fine, they can do that. There's different kinds of muffin people, but I just think it's so fun to find those little craters throughout your muffin.
And there's also people who like different form factors. There's the like in paper, like almost like Italian looking muffin people. Then there's the giant exploded mushroom cloud top. I'm one of those people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I even have, I think I mentioned this on the air once, I have a Chicago Metallic cheap muffin tin pan that has little indents for the giant exploded mushrooms so that they don't spread past where they're supposed to on the thing. And if you dose your muffin batter just right, you can't tell that I've cheated because there's only a little bit of an up curve on the side of where the exploded mushroom head is. It's a pretty key invention.
But I don't have my little doser at home, and I did a video shoot yesterday at home for the muffin recipe from the book, and I used 2 spoons to scoop it in, and my muffins just were like insane, exploding in every direction.
In a good way or a bad way?
I didn't like it.
Jack, are you ready to have your mind blown by this tip that Angela gives in the book?
Yeah, blow it.
You get a cake. Someone gets you a cake, you make a cake. All right? This has happened. Okay. This is what has happened. Okay. What do? You slice it now and freeze frozen slices.
Oh, my God. It's such a good idea. Wow. Genius. That's the smartest. You were so correct about my mind being blown. Wow.
That can't be new information to you.
That's right. It is. That's brand new information. Incredible.
Oh, come on.
No, because you don't think about it.
I just ordered a copy of the book, and a friend, this is the tip that I'm going to use to sell your book to the masses, because, wow, that's brilliant.
I mean, it's like, what do you want to do? You have a leftover cake.
Especially in the time of COVID.
Yeah.
Especially in a time of any time in your whole freaking life. If you want a slice of cake and you froze the rest of a birthday cake and you're like, oh man, I really want a slice right now. Here are my options. Shave off a tiny piece and eat it frozen, or wait for hours. You don't want to do either of those. You want to eat a slice of cake right now.
Oh my gosh. Oh, and it's a hurdle right there that keeps me from making cakes in the home, because I'm like, oh, well, geez, you know, if I bake this whole cake, I'm living alone right now. I'm going to have to eat the whole dang thing. It's brilliant.
You're killing me.
I feel like an idiot. I feel so foolish for not having come up with this.
You're killing me.
Wow.
Yeah.
No, you're keeping me alive. So,
hey, can I give you guys another mind blow that's not from this book, but that I recently learned, and I can only mention it because it's from a future classics in the field that I didn't want to mention when Matt from Kitchen Arts and Letters was on last week, but I ordered a copy of the book, so I no longer have to worry about the three copies that are online now getting sold because I've already purchased my copy. You ready for a tip?
Yeah.
Tip away.
Guy's name was Monroe Boston Strauss, the Pie King of Los Angeles, wrote a book called Pie Marches On that never got hugely popular because every recipe in the book is written for 10 pies or more because he was writing for commercial establishments and not for people cooking at home. He was rediscovered by Shirley Corriher, who's also going to have at Classics in the Field hopefully at some point soon. Anyways, maybe when Harold McGee comes on next, we'll do Shirley Corriher, which would be fun. But or maybe have her on because she's still around. I just don't know her that well. But get this tip. So all my life, I've been blind baking crusts, and I've been doing the weights. I've been doing the blah, the double panning, all this other stuff. The guy's like, no, no, no. No, what you do is you turn the pie pan upside down and bake it on the outside of the freaking pie pan.
Oh.
Boom!
That's crazy.
Right?
That is wild.
Right? And he's like, listen, I'm a professional. Yeah, he's like, I have so many different kinds of pie pans. So I have a slightly smaller one. I turn it upside down. I bake it. And then if I need it to have the structure of a pie pan later, I can always invert it into a bigger pie pan. Dun, dun, dun. Dun, dun, dun. No shrink, no puff. No shrink, no puff. Because how many times in your life have you blind baked something and the freaking crust slides down into your pan?
Oh, a lot.
Or puffs up crazy.
I mean, or I just choose not to blind bake. And
you want another tip from my man Monroe Boston Strauss?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. Keep him coming. So, he's clearly
So he did, first of all, he. Angela, you need to look up this dude's book because it's on the internet. You can read the whole book on the internet. But like the way this guy goes into depth on particular fruit fillings, crazy. But check this. So his graham cracker crust was originally developed as a moisture management problem. And you know I'm concerned about that for the Miracle of Moisture Management book, which I may or may not be writing. However, here's how he does it. He has two different main kinds of graham cracker crusts. And it depends on whether you want to do one side or both. And he has very particular things. And you're like, what do you mean one side or both? Because what he does is he makes graham crackers, makes a traditional pie crust, and then uses graham cracker as the flour on the board and rolls graham cracker into a traditional pie crust.
What?
Wouldn't that be delicious for so many different things? Yes! Yes! Yes!
Who is this guy?
I mean, he's long since dead. But I mean,
oh, come on.
I mean, how do I not know about this? I am 49. How do I not know this stuff? Oh my God.
What year did this book come out?
It was originally written in the 30s. It was reprinted in the late 30s, early 40s. And it was reprinted once, I believe, in the 50s and maybe once again in the 60s. But they just never did a big run of it because it was only for commercial people. Literally every recipe is like makes 10 pies. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Man, that is awesome.
Amazing that book. You should all look it up.
That's such a tip.
Dave, we gotta bounce.
Well, no, I gotta. Well, first of all, I have questions. Obviously, I didn't get to. Let me ask one more reader question. Eileen writes in because this Angela will be good for this. I am typically pro egg, but my friend thinks she has an allergy and is anti egg. But we're still friends, and she's trying to make a coconut bread that calls for 5 eggs. That's all the information she gave me. Do you know of any substitute she can use in that recipe that might yield something that's in the ballpark of delicious as opposed to gross? Would you use your flax eggs for that? Or I know some of your recipes you say you can substitute eggs, and some that you
don't. Yeah, I don't know. It really, really depends. Like, you could give it a shot. Sometimes, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Does it have coconut flour? Is it just a regular quick bread that has coconut in it? I think it's too hard to tell without actually seeing the recipe. All right.
Well, maybe she can write back in and I'll send it to you.
What if you did like a couple flax eggs and then like a little more, I assume there's some kind of milk as a liquid in there. And then like, cause if you did 5 flax eggs, it's just going to be like a really gummy mess. So maybe do 2 instead of all 5 and then bulk it up with a little more milk.
Matt, could I have a couple minutes to ask some specific questions about the book? Because I don't get to talk to Angela that often. A little bit. Come on, man. I want to ask her about some of these recipes, man. Come on, man.
5 minutes. Yeah.
All right. Peach coffee cake, your grandma's recipe that you redid and you said it was one of the last things that she ever had. Is this one of the recipes we need to make out of your book?
You have to make the peach coffee cake. I mean, and I think that you will agree with me on this, Dave. You can only use canned peaches for this recipe. So it is a yeast dough on the bottom and then some canned peaches and then a coconut oil crumble on top. It's kind of like an Eastern European style thing. She was a Polish immigrant, and I don't know if she made this recipe up or if somebody gave it to her, but it is one of the best things. I have tried it with fresh peaches. I have tried canning my own peaches. It really, really benefits from like an actual canned peach, because what kind of like leaks out of those peaches makes like almost like a custardy sort of vibe with the dough. It's super good.
Jack, when is canned peach season?
Always.
Yep.
But this, it points out one of the things I love about the book is that, and you know, hopefully we're not going to have time, I guess, to talk about it, but like it's a super interesting combination of what you would call kind of high concept. I mean, remember, like, you know, Angela was working at like 3 Michelin-star restaurants, and like high concept and also really homey, like her past, like the future. Like, so you'll have a recipe that was her grandma's, and then at the same time you'll have a recipe for cardamom, pistachio, strawberry, rose, cake. So it's like super interesting kind of combination of things, which I always enjoy to see how someone thinks on different levels and with different, in different kind of flavor regimes. All right, so they're gonna get cut off quick. Turtle cookies. So these are basically brownaloids that are cooked in a waffle iron for only like 60 seconds. Are they still kind of raw in the middle?
No, they're not raw at all. They're like fully cooked little. So it's like a brownie batter that you basically put into a standard waffle iron, not Belgian waffle iron. And they just cook in like 60 seconds. And it is one of the best things. And then you put peanut butter frosting on top. One of my favorite things that my mom made growing up.
All right. Get this, people, because this is not something I would have thought was delicious, but you go out of your way to say it is, so I'm going to ask you about it. Buckwheat chocolate chunk cookies.
Oh, yeah.
See, it's not what I would think of buckwheat. What do you think, Jack? How does that sound?
I think it sounds delicious. What do you have against buckwheat?
I like buckwheat. You know I like buckwheat, except for when it's made into, soba noodles, and then someone rinses all the flavor out of it so that it tastes like it's made with nothing. That's the only time I don't like it. But, I mean, I love buckwheat,
You're not the only one who thinks that. So my husband was like not totally on board with them. My staff was not totally on board with them. It was one of the demos I did for Charleston Wine and Food last year. And I was like, this is going to be perfect. This is like such a cool thing. The grain is so delicious. And I started making it for my staff and made it for my husband. They're like, holy, you know, this is like very, very good. And I think I specifically say in the recipe that if you chop up chocolate, like a chocolate bar, or even chop up your chocolate chips, you're going to kind of get that chocolate dust throughout the cookie as well. And I'm not like a chocolate chip person in my cookies, but this, when the dust kind of goes throughout that really like nutty buckwheat, super soft cookie, it's super
sweet. Yeah. Okay. Chocolate Thunder Cake from the book Thunder Cake by Patricia Polacco. I've never heard of this book. You want to give me like a quick thing on this book and this, and do you like this recipe? Yeah. Is this a good recipe or is this just your childhood talking?
I made it my own from this childhood book. So I used to read that book a lot with my grandma, my mom. So it's about a little girl who's a thunderstorm starts. She's super scared, and to distract her, her grandma says, we have to go around the farm and get all of the ingredients to make thunder cake. And we have to get all of the ingredients and make the cake and get it in the oven before the rain starts. So it's like the grandma's way of distracting the little girl. And so they run around the whole farm and they get like tomatoes, because there's tomato puree in the cake, and eggs and all of this stuff. It's just a very, very sweet story. And the recipe is just a really, really rich chocolate cake that I recommend with chocolate ganache.
To chocolate it up. Speaking of chocolate on chocolate on chocolate, what about your Babe Squares? That looks like death by chocolate.
That is definitely death by chocolate. That's something that's like a little too much chocolate for me, but it's a chocolate almond shortbread crust with chocolate ganache filling and then a chocolate crumble on top.
Sounds like that recipe could use some chocolate in it. What do you think?
I think that it should just definitely have more chocolate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, hey, since I'm on a time schedule here. So funerals and brownies. Talk to me about funerals and brownies.
This is just a great chocolate. It's a great brownie recipe. It's super fudgy if you're a fudgy brownie person, because there are different kinds of brownie people with walnuts in it. And I made them for my Grandma Carriato's funeral, and they became the brownie for funerals. I made hundreds of them for this funeral. And my mom was like, yo, those funeral brownies were pretty good. And so we just started calling them funeral brownies. And my editor reached out recently and she was like, probably not the best time for that recipe.
Well, or the best time.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, Matt, nuts in brownies, yes or no?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
I don't ever hear someone have such a, what, Jack, yes or no on the nuts?
Sometimes.
What that is with you people? Usually people are either like nuts or no nuts. Very rarely.
Well, I like a wide variety. I don't eat a lot of baked goods, but when I do, I eat them sort of broadly. Like, I enjoy many, and I like a wide variety. I think coffee is a bigger every time inclusion in brownies for me than nuts are.
I have never put them in my own brownies, but yeah, I put coffee in cookies a bunch too. I like where your head's at, Jack.
Angela, you said that you hadn't heard of this cake till recently, and I haven't heard of this cake until yesterday when you sent me a copy of your book, Hummingbird Cake. Good recipe, interesting. Talk to me about hummingbird cake.
It's a great recipe. It's like a banana cake that has pineapple, nuts, and coconut in it. How could that be a bad recipe?
Oh my God, great. Are you ready for this? Boston Monroe Strauss, or Monroe Boston Strauss, but Pie March is on. Remember this guy we're talking about? He makes a banana cream. He makes a banana cream pie with pineapple juice as the liquid in the crust, and a little bit of pineapple in it. So he's down with that pineapple banana action too.
Oh my God, that's brilliant!
This is that guy who released a book in the 30s.
Yeah. Wow. All right, now
banana cream pie, king of pies.
What? Everything about pies. Yeah.
Banana cream pie is the king of pies, though. That's my hot take.
Okay, so this guy, Strauss, not because we're talking about Angela today, not about Strauss. Strauss literally invented the chiffon pie.
Whoa.
I mean, crazy. Anyway, cheesecake. I noticed you have the cheesecake recipe in, but you haven't figured out a way to undairy that sucker.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people use like tofu. That's not really my jam. I would rather just make something that I can't necessarily eat that is just really delicious, but it satisfies the gluten-free crowd because it has a nut crust. So, you know, sometimes things just are what they are.
Yeah. Your coconut cake, pretty cake or prettiest cake?
Prettiest.
Yeah, that cake is crazy. also, by the way, for people, like a baller move ends the book with an essay from her mom. Sick move.
Dude, did you read that essay?
Yeah.
It's so good.
But I've never seen that move. It's such a sick move.
So my mom is a journalist and a technical writer by trade for 40 years or whatever. And you can tell our writing styles are so different. I'm a very emotional, sentimental writer. Hers, it's just facts. And it is awesome. She talks about my grandma living through the Spanish flu epidemic. It's a really, especially with Mother's Day coming up and with everything that's going on right now, I feel like I feel really lucky to have that in there.
No, it's definitely very cool. Next, like, I know they're kicking me off here, but I didn't answer any of your questions that are cocktail related people. We'll get it next time. Maybe Jack will come back on and answer it. I need someone.
I tell you what, I got a lot of free time.
I need someone in Cooking Issues land to help Milos from Toronto who has wants to make a nocino. Now, those green walnuts are coming into season now, so he probably needs, or soon, so he probably needs recommendations fairly soon. So if someone could send in nocino suggestions, that would be appreciated. I feel like I could talk to you all day about this book. And oh, what about the fact that you bake your donuts, though? One more bone to pick. Baked donuts? Come on, man.
I know, but do you know how expensive it is to get another 4 feet on your hood to get a fryer underneath?
I will accept this as an answer. But
I'm rolling around in dollar bills, and I can add another 4 feet to my hood whenever I want.
This is okay. You're, as usual, you are correct. let me see what else. Oh, also one more. I love that you call out. See, the thing is like, what's hilarious. She calls out biscotti, and for those of you that are my age, right? Biscotti was the 90s pastry, like, par excellence. Like, you could not, like, walk out of your – the way that you walk out of your apartment now and you trip on somebody's spent mask and, like, glove and all sorts of medical waste all over the streets, that's the way it used to be at stores and biscotti. Everyone. It was everywhere. Mostly really bad ones. And honestly, that was the one thing that my wife used to like to bake in the 90s was the old Cook's Illustrated, I believe it was, biscotti recipe, which was actually quite good. But I love, like, the little stories, how you point out, like, kind of how dated the biscotti is, and you're like, let's bring biscotti back. I like that.
There's nothing wrong with biscotti.
There is nothing wrong with it. Although, are you a dip or a not dip? I'm actually a not dip.
It kind of depends for me.
Sometimes I just don't like... I don't want all that stuff smearing on my face. If I'm gonna bite into it and it's gonna be hard as hell and I'm gonna have that right, I don't then also want a smear of chocolate around my face. I would rather just eat some chocolate and then crunch on the biscotti.
Yeah, it kind of depends what kind of biscotti you're eating too.
And if you're gonna dip the biscotti into something else,
yeah, you definitely don't want the chocolate if you're gonna do the coffee dip. Not that I ever.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not a coffee dip because I like the whole teeth crushed thing. Okay, listen, on your buns, I know you're known for your buns. You have two different bun recipes because in your mind, you can choose to either not have gluten or not have egg, but you may not choose both, right?
Unfortunately, that is where we are right now.
Mm-hmm. You feel like you're going to get past that at a certain point, or is that just not a problem you're focused on?
Now that we're doing... You know, with everything going on in supply chains, we're going to, I feel like, have to make a lot of different decisions. So hopefully it will give us a little bit more time. And now that, you know, I really thankfully got the PPP loan, so I'm able to bring some people back, and that's some testing that they can do before we're safe to open.
Cool. Which recipes do you think are actually better gluten-free? Which style of recipes?
Banana bread is really great gluten-free. The pound cake recipe that's in there, better gluten-free. I prefer the cookies.
I read your pound cake recipe. You actually think it's better than the one with gluten? Because does it get as – in other words, like, how's the density of it compared to, like, a regular gluten?
It's a little lighter.
Yeah.
So it also then it depends on what kind of pound cake person you are. It's also relative, you know? But I prefer it because it's a little bit it's like you were talking about a little bit earlier, you're not going to overmix it. So you're going to have a really fine crumb.
And on yours, can you substitute? Because you use Crisco and then you put in, I believe it was almond extract. And I forget what the other thing, lemon, yeah. Was it? Yeah. And so is that one you could substitute the butter back for and do a standard sugar buttercream or what?
100%.
And do you, I didn't remember the steps on that. Do you cream the Crisco with the sugar?
Yes.
And that's your basically most of your aeration right there. So it functions like a standard pound cake.
Yes.
It, okay. And is it hard to keep that one moist? What about, I would think some of the gluten-free flours are actually moister, right? Like the ones with sorghum are probably going to be, and tapioca are going to end up moister than their regular wheat counterparts, no?
It kind of depends. I haven't baked with wheat for such a long time, but I think you're kind of like, sometimes butter is a little bit, has more moisture. And so if you're taking away the, so like butter, more moist, wheat less, but then Crisco less moist, gluten-free flour more moist. So it's kind of like a trade-off.
All right. So listen, people, get yourselves on the inclusive baking train. Go get Perfectly Golden by Angela Gabatz. She is one of my favorite people out of Lincoln, Nebraska, where the possibilities are endless. Thanks also to Jack Schramm and John, who got kicked off by Matt in the booth. Even though his booth is Rhode Island, he kicked Matt off because it's not very nice. Not very nice, and I'm going to have to hear about it later. And I will end with this, which you have to read the whole book. Where is it? You have to read the whole book for this to make sense. But, Angela, you are a party cake. Cooking Issues!
Cooking Issues is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.